response.
Disgusting. Probably just like what most people think, to be fair. And if you're anybody like me who's suffering in a house with mould, damp and excessive cold anyway, with uninsulated houses, then it's even 10 times worse. So
it's absolutely horrendous. Because, I mean, I saw something on the news the other day where one energy company was saying, you know, get yourself a pet to keep you warm. Did you see that? And all this sort of nonsense. I mean, how are people going to manage?
The company's founder has since apologized, but he also said this.
Globally, energy prices are going up, and we need a system that consumers pay the true cost of energy. There is no way to magically make that lower.
There may not be a magical way of pushing energy prices down, but there must be something the government can do to contain the situation, like a working energy strategy.
And the simplest way of doing it would actually be measure it according to income. So those who've got more wealth and the broadest shoulders should pay most, and those who can't afford to pay least and get protected by the rest of society. But at the moment, no one's doing anything.
With barely any rise in their income and faced with rising taxes, millions of British households are shaking at the prospect of a nearly 50% increase in their energy bills in spring.
Since October last year, the energy price cap set by industry regulator Ofgem has been at more than $1,700. That is expected to change in April by nearly $1,000 when Ofgem sets the new cap, resulting in British homeowners' energy bills rising significantly.
You're going to see pressure on the weakest this year, and that's what's so unfair. There'll be more discontent. Does it mean there'll be riots and things like that? No, but there'll probably be demonstrations of people concerned about the level of poverty.
While the British government drags its feet on dealing with the looming cost of living catastrophe caused by stalling wages and rising tax and energy bills, less fortunate Britons will have a tough winter to battle through, with or without a pet for warmth. Saipur is up, London.
Year-end data shows that 2021 saw a massive, deadly, and record worsening of the situation for asylum seekers trying to enter the United Kingdom from France. The size of the Calais refugee camp tripled to 30,000 people, even though camp demolitions occur almost daily and treatment is routinely denounced as inhumane. Nearly 30,000 refugees reached the United Kingdom last year, but at the cost of 1,000 people who became shipwrecked, resulting in at least 44 deaths. November saw almost 30 refugees drown in a single night, the deadliest such incident ever recorded in the English Channel. 3 years ago, Paris and London decided that France would close all routes to the UK, leaving dangerous sea crossings the only option.
What's become known as Fortress Europe has gotten better and better at organizing themselves to become even more harsh and even more deadly. The aim is to show the world's refugees, look at how badly you will be received. Don't come here anymore.
Late last month, a French NGO filed a manslaughter lawsuit against the coast guards of both France and the United Kingdom for allegedly ignoring the drowning boat's distress calls to the rescue services of both nations.
We're on a path which is incredible in how it is both lamentable and repeatable. Unless we do something immediately, such atrocities will continue. The European Union has allowed the Mediterranean Sea to become the biggest graveyard in the world. Must we make the English Channel a rival?
The vast majority of refugees in the world are caused by Western military interventions, often led by France and the UK, in places like Syria, Mali, Afghanistan, Libya, Iraq, and elsewhere. Politicians in both the UK and France, where a presidential election campaign is effectively underway, have been repeatedly accused of scapegoating immigrants in order to win over their domestic electorates, which lean heavily to the political right. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
...82% of the UK's population has been fully vaccinated against COVID-19. There is vaccine hesitancy in every community, but in some more than others. The proportion of unvaccinated people is roughly twice as high in South Asian people and four times as high among black people.
There's a long history of medical abuse in our communities. We have disproportionate impacts on medical interventions be that sickle cell anemia, be that infant mortality in the first year of life, a whole range of conditions. Vaccine hesitancy and skepticism is quite high in our community and has to be acknowledged. You can't berate people into doing the right thing.
Doctors have urged unvaccinated Black and South Asian people to get their COVID jabs after new data revealed hospitalizations and deaths are higher in these groups. But there seems to be little appetite for it. More than 90% of all white people aged 50 to 54 have been vaccinated with a first dose. That compares with just 62% of those of Caribbean heritage.
To find out more, we've come to Brixton, a part of London that has a thriving Afro-Caribbean community.
But plenty of people that don't want to take it, they said they don't know what's in it. They said they don't know what's in it, and it makes some people sick. Because me, when I had it, I was off work for 2 months straight.
The community, they think Boris is just a player. He's not explaining exactly what he needs to do or what he's doing. And 1 week, he changed his mind. It's a game. He's playing a game. And people are not children.
A lot of people are not taking no vaccine now. You see? A lot. For me, my kids, no. My kids, they work in the hospital. So in the hospital, probably they will tell them to take something. I don't know. But for me, no.
The Black community is more likely to live in a densely populated area, work in public-facing roles such as health and social care, and live in large and multi-generational households.
The pandemic should be seen as a magnifying lens that has amplified existing disadvantage and has made that acutely aggravated. So whatever was the problems before, Black and ethnic minority youth unemployment has doubled during the pandemic. That we've seen the rate of mental ill health and breakdown within our community go off the charts.
Vaccine hesitancy is not unfounded. Historical medical experiments conducted on Black people remain in their psyche, far outweighing their fear of COVID-19. So now, they'd rather see the vaccines tested on the white people first. Bianca Rahimi, London.
Syrian President Bashar al-Assad met Iranian Minister of Roads and Urban Development Rustam Qasimi. During the meeting, the two sides discussed means of expanding bilateral cooperation in public and private sectors, as well as encouraging further joint investments. Assad underlined the importance of starting new projects that achieve strategic and joint benefits for the two states and link business sectors in Syria and Iran. Qasimi, for his part, renewed his country's support to Syria in fighting terrorism and assisting the Syrian people. The Iranian official also met with Syria's Foreign Minister Faisal al-Maqdad. They asserted determination to reach a significant level of trade exchange and economic partnerships.
I met today with President Assad. We discussed economic topics and agreed on forming a joint committee to remove all obstacles on the way of expansion of mutual ties. I also met with Syria's Foreign Minister. We agreed to set a plan for developing economic relations between the two countries and regional states.
We discussed economic relations. Nothing at all can block expansion of our economic relations. We discussed partnerships in the transport sector. Syria is interested in heading eastwards, as President Assad stressed back in 2005.
Qasimi also met with his Syrian counterpart and reached agreements on consolidating cooperation in the transport sector. The Iranian delegation's visit aims to further activate economic ties, mainly in the transport sector, increase the number of flights between both countries, as well as the bulk of trade exchange. Qasimi's visit comes following a similar one by Iran's Minister of Trade, Industry and Mine less than 2 months ago. Talks recently between both countries' officials have focused on establishing partnerships with the aim of boosting their economies together to counter economic sanctions imposed by their enemies. Muhammad Ali, Damascus.
Ever since the Great Recession began, decreased purchasing power has been the number one complaint of French voters. Because one in four Frenchmen suffers from a serious housing problem, Emmanuel Macron made better and more housing a central plank of his 2017 presidential campaign. Today, inflation just hit record highs in France and across the Eurozone, and housing has become even more expensive during the coronavirus crisis.
A recent poll showed that 3 out of 4 French people feels that their purchasing power has diminished, and 90% of the country is concerned about it. While the elite may be able to afford these higher costs, it's clear that the rest of France is deeply concerned.
Top NGOs and some unions gathered in Paris to warn all candidates that recent years have seen untold socioeconomic damage, which could result in more political upheavals.
And this is the reason why these organizations have come together, to be able to raise a cry of alarm and try and intervene in the campaign.
Affordable housing has long established fixes. Write laws which favor tenants and not landlords. Put more tax revenue into building new housing and create more shelters for those with emergency needs. The Macron era has implemented none of these solutions, which has allowed the price of real estate to cross the records of 10,000 euros per square meter in Paris and 3,000 euros nationwide. Inflated or not, real estate must be heated in winter, and record energy prices has the government already admitting they are worried about the social fallout which soaring prices could cause, as in 2018 with the yellow vests.
In the election, socioeconomic questions will be very prevalent because inequalities have gotten so much worse in recent years. Households are either having major problems paying their bills or simply getting evicted. The current government has made no initiatives to remedy these problems, especially regarding housing.
Some believe that housing is for living in, and some believe that housing is for investment speculation. But in a French election dominated by right-wingers, the leading candidates will be forced to at least pay lip service to the idea of state-sponsored remedies to soaring prices.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who allowed none to witness when He created the heavens and the earth, and who took no helper when He authored the spirits. He has no associate in divinity and no support in unity. Tongues fall silent before the limits of describing Him. Intellects fail before the core of knowing Him. Terence fall low in awe of Him. faces are humbled in fear of him, and everything mighty yields to his mightiness. So to thee belongs praise again and again, well measured, continually and methodically. And may his blessings be upon his messenger endlessly, and his salutation everlastingly, eternally. O Allah, make the beginning of this day of mine righteousness, its middle prosperity, and its end success. I seek refuge in thee from a day whose beginning is fright, and whose middle is anxiety, and whose end is pain. O Allah, I pray forgiveness from thee for every vow I have vowed, and every promise I have promised, and every pledge I have pledged, then fail to keep for thee. I ask thee concerning the complaints of thy servants against me. If there is a servant from among thy servants, of a handmaid from among thy handmaids, who has against me a complaint, because I have wronged him in respect to himself, his reputation, his property, his wife or his child, or because evil words I have spoken about him in his absence, an imposition upon him through inclination, caprice, scorn, zeal, false show, bigotry, whether he be absent or present, alive or dead, such that my hand has fallen short and my capacity has been too narrow to make restitution to him or to annul my obligation to him, I ask thee, O he who owns all objects of need which are granted by his will and hastened to his desire, that thou blessest Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, peace be upon them, and makes the one I have wronged satisfied with me in the manner that thou willst, and givest me mercy from thee. Forgiveness decreases thee not, and giving injuries thee not. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, give me on every Monday two favors from thee: the facility to obey thee at its beginning, and the favor of thy forgiveness at its end. O he who is Allah, and none other than whom grants forgiveness for sins.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The spotlight.
Called the Police Crime Sentencing and Courts Bill. If passed through Parliament, the bill will give more power to the police to shut down demonstrations and protesters, could even face prison, which could make peaceful protests and marches a thing of the past. Why did the UK Home Secretary suggest such a bill in the first place? Well, in this edition of the Spotlight, we will look at whether this bill represents a massive assault on civil liberties and other aspects of this bill which have been called a violation of human rights.
Soon, this might be illegal in the UK. Holding a banner, beating a drum, and raising your voice in protest. The government's controversial Police, Crime, Sentencing, and Courts Bill is currently being debated at the House of Lords. If passed, any non-violent public assembly could be snuffed out.
There is a sense of impending doom. People here fear an Orwellian scenario in which democracy as they know it, although flawed, will become a thing of the past.
The new police powers would set conditions on the duration of protests, noise levels, and locations. The British feel the walls are closing in on them, manifesting in more than just this bill.
We've got the worst poverty in Europe. We're most of us an unequal country in Europe. And we have one of the highest death rates from COVID in Europe as a result. Its treatment of migrants is absolutely appalling.
These are the citizens of the UK saying, we want to, we demand that we live in a free country. We are all here to defend ourselves, our rights, and journalists and publishers like Julian Assange who speak up and tell us what our governments are doing.
The bill also proposes to introduce new laws that penalize stopping on private and public land without authorization. This would have the effect of criminalizing the way of life of Gypsy, Roma, and Traveller people.
This is an attack on our right to protest. It's an attack on Gypsy, Roma, and Travellers people's right to live, where they've lived in their way of living for like time immemorial. We're seeing more stringent rules, more brutal rules being brought in, more strong policing powers, not just here, but around the world. We're seeing the Zionists upping the ante on the Palestinian people.
All of our struggles are connected, and we're representing the Arab people, and representing the fight against the state and against people's ability to speak against the state is crucial wherever we are.
The Tory government is fishing in murky waters, taking advantage of distractions like the pandemic to push through draconian laws like the police bill and the borders and nationality bill. But the people out on London streets say they have the government sussed and won't stand for it. Bianca Rahimi, London.
Our guest joining us for this edition of The Spotlight. First, we have human rights activist and campaigner Natalie Strecker joining us from Jersey Channel Islands. Also joining us, former British MP Chris Williamson, who joins us from Derby, the UK.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Okay, welcome to you both. Looking at those scenes in those protests were pretty telling. So I'm going to start with you, Natalie Strecker, if I may. It's called Police Crime Sentencing and Courts Bill, huge piece of legislation covering many aspects of the UK criminal justice system. Perhaps you can tell us what the controversial aspects of it are.
Well, I would say that there's probably too many to mention this evening. I mean, obviously, in effect, it outlaws protest. We see the targeting of minority groups, the legislation that will impact the Gypsy, Roma and Traveller community, which we need to remember is one of the most discriminated communities within the UK, not just in recent years, but actually since medieval times. And I think when we talk about the Gypsy, Roma and Traveller community, it's important to remember them in the context more widely of Europe, and how alongside the Jews they were the only other people that were identified as a group for extermination. And I think it's really important to remind people of that as we think about how this bill will impact them. But there's lots of other things. As per usual we see very ambiguous language used about the outlawing of people attaching themselves to things and to people. But what does attach mean? Does it mean just when you observe people locking themselves in, as you quite often see at arms factories and arms fairs, or does it also possibly mean people linking arms? So I think that there's numerous aspects of this bill, and actually amendments that I'm not even aware of as yet, of course, which have been added since before it went into the House of the Lords. So I think it's deeply concerning legislation and violates our human and civil rights on all levels.
Sure. Chris Williamson, I'm wondering what the thinking behind this was. I'm not sure if you can answer this, but, you know, was it something that they actually looked at to initially target certain segments of the British society, perhaps? For example, the ones who come out in protest, for example, the Roma, for example, minorities. Is that the approach, perhaps, that was used? Because it sure looks that way. And leading to the question, which seems to be the most controversial one, and that is to ban marches and demonstrations because they believe that it might seriously, and I don't know if I read this correctly, seriously disruptive, including being too noisy?
Well, I mean, I think the neoliberal capitalist system in this country is broken down, it isn't working, and people are fed up and are increasingly wanting to express their concerns about the way democracy operates in this country. We have a climate catastrophe on the horizon. People are rightly concerned about that. The government isn't acting swiftly enough to deal with that. We see racism and bigotry increasing in this country. We've seen the emergence of the Black Lives Matter campaigners. And obviously this has sent a shiver down the spine, it seems to me, of the establishment, because people are flexing their muscles. They are using the democratic right to demonstrate and to put pressure on the government. And it seems to me that this is an attempt to squash protest and to, you know, prevent these sort of inconvenient truths being highlighted on the streets. And this is a very dangerous and slippery slope, it seems to me, when we're talking about potentially jailing people for, you know, up to a year because, you know, they're protesting and you know, police don't like the noise or the route that they wish to take on a march, for example. And I think the other proposition, to potentially jail people for 10 years for defacing or damaging memorials. But I mean, we saw this last year or the year before, I think it was, where a slave trader who'd been venerated in Bristol had this statue torn down and thrown into the river. And obviously people are rightly upset and concerned about the way in which Britain's imperialist past is actually promoted and exalted, and it seems to me people have an absolute right to challenge that, and the government are seeking to prevent this and to clamp down in the most repressive way possible. I mean, this is reminiscent of a tin pot dictatorship, not the country which is supposed to pride itself on democracy.
Sure, but Priti Patel seems to think that this is okay, and I'm wondering what you would tell her, Natalie Strecker, when she says, yes, peaceful protest remains a cornerstone of democracy, but argues that there has been a significant change in protest tactics. So she's coming in on protest tactics through that angle, in which she says protesters are exploiting gaps in the law.
Obviously there's lots of things I would say to Priti Patel, but probably most of them are not appropriate at this moment whilst being interviewed. I guess what I would say is, if we just need to look at our history, you know, if I speak as a female, how was it we gained our rights just to be able to vote and to be seen as equals within society? Was only possible through the tactics that are being used currently today. You know, the women had to take themselves on the streets, take direct action to be noisy. You know, there isn't, the problem is, you know, if we look at the other tactics, quite often you'll have people sit down and sign petitions, but we know that no change really comes without people being noisy. And that's one of our rights. And, you know, I've spoken about women's suffrage, but also the civil rights movement, you know, the movement to end the slave trade. I think that Priti Patel needs, quite often, they'll talk about, you know, in November, near Remembrance Day, the importance of the sacrifices our soldiers, our grandparents, parents made in order to gain our freedoms. They talk about this a lot, and yet, you know, at this very moment, they're looking at removing those freedoms that were fought for. So are they really honouring the sacrifices they make when they're looking at bringing such draconian laws? And listening to what Chris said about a tin pot dictatorship, you know, I would say Priti Patel is a tin pot dictator. And I think it's not just authoritarian, it's actually fascist that we see ourselves slipping into the UK. It's really good. I would encourage people to look up the Warning Signs of Fascism, which is at a Holocaust museum, and it highlights the different steps. And we have ticked pretty much all of those steps now. So it is really frightening times, just as ordinary human beings who want to take a stance for things that are important to us. And what I would add is that this isn't even a left-right issue. It comes down to whether we believe in basic freedom of speech, whether we believe in the protection of our civil liberties and individual liberties.
Indeed. That's the point that has been made. We're going to talk about that in a broader respect when it comes to the UK, but I can't help but also look at this, Chris Williamson, in terms of some of the not only most colorful protests, but some of the most vociferous and large-scale protests that have taken place in the UK over the years, which has to deal with the issue of Palestine. And I'm wondering, given the close relationship that this government, especially Priti Patel, has with Israel, that do you think that this could be one of the driving forces that maybe led as an incentive to come up with the laws and provisions behind this?
Well, I'm sure that was featured in their thinking. I don't think that was the only factor, but I'm sure that certainly was one of them. You're absolutely right. And it's not just Priti Patel, of course, that's very close to the Israeli apartheid regime. I mean, you know, the vast majority of parliamentarians are supporters of the apartheid state of Israel. Half the members of the Parliamentary Labour Party, which is supposed to be the party that stands up for civil rights and democracy and anti-imperialism, and yet around 50% of the Parliamentary Labour Party are members of an organisation called Labour Friends of Israel. So yes, certainly. And I think now, because in this modern age of smartphones and so on, what we're seeing is citizen journalism taking place in Gaza, and you know, young people who have learnt good English in the UN schools there are able to use their smartphones and then to upload those images onto the internet, which actually illustrate the absolute barbarity of the Israeli regime and the propaganda that we are relentlessly subjected to in this country and have been, you know, ever since Israel was established and back in 1948. And much of the atrocities that they perpetrated were unknown to the British people. Well, that's no longer the case. And the bombardment that we saw against Gaza in the spring of last year saw people coming onto the streets in this country in unprecedented numbers, and not just in the capital either. Up and down the country, small towns and large cities in the provinces saw people coming onto the street. In my own city of Derby, which is a modest-sized city, it saw the biggest demonstration in Derby's history in support of the Palestinian people. Now, of course, this is something which the government, it seems to me, are not prepared to tolerate.
Sure.
And I'm sure that this will be used, if these measures are successfully put onto the statute book, to limit the ability of people to highlight the atrocities of the Israeli regime and to support the Palestinian people. But of course, it goes much wider than that, and you know, we've seen the Insulate Britain activists in this country who have been drawing attention to the scandal of fuel poverty, with millions of people struggling to heat their homes, having to make desperate choices between eating adequately or heating their homes adequately. And there's all sorts of health conditions. Thousands of people die every single year in this country, in the fifth biggest economy in the world, because they can't afford to heat their homes properly, let alone the impact of climate change is having on the way of life of people, if indeed nothing is done to actually address that. And so,
sure,
you know, they are taking direct action methods. I mean, and Natalie talked about the role of the suffragettes and the direct action that they engaged in. And
sure,
you know, direct action has an absolute and important role to play in a democracy. And it's through direct action, actually, that many of the advances that we made in this country in terms of democratic rights for the citizens of Britain has been brought about in the first instance as a consequence of direct action. And
sure.
This is a real attempt to try and, you know, stifle it and prevent it. But I'm sure they won't succeed. And, you know, people, it will make people more determined. But what we will see is our prisons filling up.
Okay.
Of course, there's an issue there because all of our prisons have been privatised. So there's money to be made out of imprisoning people in this country. It's an absolute scandal. The system is completely broken in this country. And people are waking up to that. And regrettably, we've got establishment parties on both sides
right.
of the chamber in Parliament who are not really speaking up for the people. So people are taking to the streets to actually make their voices heard. And as I say, this is an attempt to stop them actually having their voices heard and the pressure being applied.
Well, that's the whole issue here, Natalie Strecker. I think our guest there, in a sense, nailed it on the head when Chris Williamson said that this is not going to stop people from coming out. We could talk about what may amount as the protests take place and then the police make decisions as to whether these protests are following any guidelines or not. But I'd like to take a look at the bigger picture there in the UK when it comes to just freedom, when it comes to the whole notion of democracy, because you in a sense talk about how this is becoming a fascist state, perhaps authoritarian. I think you used the word dictatorship. I know that the UK has, by some accounts, been compared to being a police state. Maybe that also leads to the lines that you were speaking about the UK in terms of the freedom being chipped away at. This is a big strike to freedom in the UK. What are the consequences that we're going to see as a result of this? What other areas can you name for us if you can?
Well, I mean, obviously, it's going to impact every area of our life, you know, because if it's, I mean, a lot of this is about whether the police agree for you having a protest or the government. Well, it's if the government agrees with it, then it's not really a protest, is it? It's a parade. And I think it's important to kind of remember that. But, you know, Chris quite rightly said before about the different things that are, you know, society is unraveling as we see the collapsing of capitalism, the neoliberal project, as we see ecological breakdown, escalating. This is going to cause more and more unrest. So in terms of freedoms, if people don't have the right to go out on the streets, then it's going to impact other freedoms, the freedom and the right to life, you know, the right to security and all these other things. I think it's deeply concerning, but also how it will impact education that takes place, you know, the sense of, you know, the personal agency that we have as individuals. I think there are so many ways that this will impact us. And of course, we're focusing on a policing bill, but there are other bills that have been brought in already that signals that we are now living in a police state. So if you look at the covert Human Intelligence Sources Bill, which in effect means that the police and the intelligence agencies are able to commit any crime against, private citizens without exception. There is no without caveat. You know, we're not, whereas in the past this used to be, you know, for the ambiguous term national security, this can also be used in terms of protecting the UK economy from harm. Well, what does that mean? Does it mean a trade unionist trying to organise a general strike or to protect, to prevent public disorder? What does that mean? Does it mean, torturing or even killing, you know, somebody
sure.
who's looking to raise, you know, a subject matter that impacts them? So I think that it's hollowing out our civil liberties, and it's going to impact our freedoms. And in fact, there's probably things that we haven't even anticipated at this moment in time. And one thing I perhaps didn't mention when we're talking about the different aspects of the law is this ASBO, really, that if somebody's been to protests that haven't been approved of, and, you know, two protests, I think it is, in the last 5 years, this bill will prevent them from being not only being able to attend protests, but also being able to encourage people on social media or elsewhere to attend protests.
Right.
It's deeply concerning.
Sure, of course, because they don't want you to spread the word or trying to gather people, whether it's through social media means or otherwise. And you talked about other legislation that's being debated, and I have to ask you about this one because this has raised eyebrows and shocked many, Chris Williamson, and that is the Nationality and Borders Bill. which, among other provisions, it would allow government to strip people of their British citizenship. You know, when you take a look at that, and they can do that without notice, it seems like. What is your impression of that? I mean, you know, when you add up all these different things that are happening in the UK, of laws that are going to be passed or will be passed, it really does come down to perhaps what our guest there, Natalie, has said.
Very controversial, and you'd think, given the scandal of the what happened to the Windrush generation, where we saw people, children who'd lived here all their lives virtually, but didn't have papers and weren't able to necessarily prove that they got British citizenship, were being deported back to the Caribbean. Absolutely outrageous, and this caused huge controversy when it eventually came to light a few years ago now. And yet here we are with this new legislation which is being put through, which is kind of a repetition and actually even worse than potentially what happened to the Windrush generation. And people are right to be fearful about the implication of this. But, you know, as well, I mean, and, you know, Natalie mentioned it, and I can't help but to refer back to the point about the Covert Human Intelligence Sources Bill, and because that actually, and there was an attempt by the opposition in the House of Commons to exclude, because it gives agents of the state the right to commit criminal conduct. And there was an attempt in the House of Commons to limit that criminal conduct, to prevent it from being used to rape, torture, or murder people. That could not be done under the basis of this criminal human intelligence sources legislation. And that was voted down. And so it seems to me the government is essentially, therefore, giving the green light to murder, rape, and torture people. I mean, this is unbelievable. What is happening? It's outrageous. And so, yes, I mean, you know, the repressive legislation which is being pushed through and which isn't being resisted sufficiently vigorously enough by the official opposition in the House of Commons, or indeed being reported upon by the corporate media, you know, by the Fourth Estate. They're doing an incredible disservice.
Sure.
To the people of this nation. And that's why public protest is so important, to actually raise these issues, because we are being ill-served by the media and by our parliamentarians, who should be there to actually hold the executive, to hold the government to account, to stop these repressive measures being pushed through. You know, Britain used to sort of pride itself on its democratic traditions, on spreading democracy around the world, and yet
indeed,
here we are in a situation where more and more repressive legislation is being pushed through almost on a kind of a monthly basis now. It's quite shocking, and it's really important that we do everything we can, I think, to mobilize opposition to it.
Sure. Who knows? Maybe next time around we can't even debate this on a media program like this one. Unfortunately, we're fresh out of time, but let me thank both of you, human rights activists and campaigner Natalie Stryker. Thank you so much for your thoughts, and former British MP Chris Williamson there from Derby, UK. Thank you so much. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Ikova Tahve, the entire team in the capital, Tehran, it's goodbye until next time.
This is IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en. Thank you.
the limelight. A year ago, Michael Macy, a barber who lives in the suburbs outside Atlanta, Georgia, was thrilled to help propel President Biden to victory, hopeful that Democrats would move swiftly to tackle policing laws and other big issues. But then he watched his hopes for sweeping changes wither in Washington. Now Mr. Macy's sense of optimism, like that of millions of Americans, has been dashed. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalist Jack Healy, Audra Birch, and Patricia Mazzai. The piece is titled Trapped in a Pandemic Funk. Millions of Americans can't shake a gloomy outlook. Stay with us for more. A year ago, Michael Macy, the barber who lives in the suburbs outside Atlanta, Georgia, was thrilled to help propel President Biden to victory, hopeful that Democrats would move swiftly to tackle policing laws and other big issues. But then he watched his hopes for sweeping changes wither in Washington. Now Michael Macy's sense of optimism, like that of millions of Americans, has been dashed by the pain of an unending pandemic, by rising prices, by nationwide bickering that stretches from school board meetings to the United States Capitol. I don't like the division, Mr. Macy, a 63-year-old, says. I don't like the standstill. We need something to get accomplished. For so many voters in this November of discontent, the State of the Union is just not acceptable. Despite many signals that things are improving, the stock market is hitting record highs, hiring is accelerating sharply with 531,000 jobs added in October, workers are earning more, and COVID hospitalizations and deaths are dropping from their autumn peaks, many Americans seem stuck in a pandemic hangover of pessimism. More than 60% of voters in opinion surveys say that their country is heading in the wrong direction. A national funk that has pummeled Joe Biden's approval ratings and fueled a backlash against Democrats that could cost them control of Congress in next year's midterm elections. In more than two dozen interviews across the country, voters ticked off a snowballing list of grievances that had undercut their faith in a president who ran on a pledge of normalcy and competence. The chaotic, deadly pullout from Afghanistan, a spike in migrants crossing the southern border with Mexico, a legislative agenda stymied by Republican opposition and Democratic infighting. The complaints are not just coming from conservatives. Voters who supported Joe Biden say they had grown dispirited about his ability to muscle through campaign pledges to address climate change, to address voting rights and economic fairness, whilst also confronting rising prices and other disruptions to daily life exacerbated by the pandemic. It's incredibly frustrating, said Daniel Sanchez, who lost his teaching contract at a community college in suburban Phoenix when enrollment plunged during the pandemic. Now he's making minimum wage at an organic market and searching for a full-time teaching job. Mr. Sanchez, a 36-year-old, says he still supports Joe Biden, echoing many Democratic voters who said they believed the president was being unfairly blamed by Republicans and the news media for problems beyond his control, such as the price of gasoline or COVID spikes among Americans who refused to get vaccinated. But Mr. Sanchez has grown exasperated with the endless melodrama in Washington as a Democratic effort to confront climate change and strengthen the social safety net has stalled amid intra-party disputes. He is particularly frustrated with two moderate Democratic senators, Joe Manchin of West Virginia and Mr. Sanchez's own senator, Kyrsten Sinema of Arizona. It seems like the answers are right in front of them and people are willing to do nothing about it, he says. President Biden came into office vowing to build back better, but voters said little was getting built as Democrats fight over multi-trillion dollar measures to strengthen the country's social safety net and improve physical infrastructure. Normal life was not back and might never be, and voters said so many things just felt worse. It is not just the federal government they blame. Trash is piling up on city streets because of a dearth of garbage haulers. School bus services are being cancelled and delayed for want of drivers. Americans who have been hurt economically by the pandemic are still struggling to get rental assistance and unemployment benefit, sometimes months after applying. Our political system is almost completely a failure, said Carla Haney, a 65-year-old swimming instructor who has yet to receive about 14 weeks of unemployment benefit from the state of Florida that she applied for back in May of 2020. I don't see it getting better at all. With a global supply chain gummed up, voters around the Phoenix metro area said they were paying the price in lost money and wasted time. A restaurant chef in Phoenix, Arizona, is once again struggling to buy paper plates and napkins. A plumbing supplier in Tempe, Arizona, is losing commissions because he cannot fill orders. And at gas stations across the country, drivers cringe at paying an average of $3.40 a gallon, prices that have risen by more than $1 a gallon from a year ago. Everything goes up, and pay pretty much stays the same, said Brandon Hendricks, a 39-year-old from Athens, Georgia, who works in security for an auto plant. Even with the unemployment rate at 4.6%, falling but still above its pandemic levels, Mr. Hendricks said job security is not his top concern. Instead, it is the rising of prices for gasoline, grocery store, rent, just because just about everything you can think of that worry him. Still, he blames much of the country's grim state on the pandemic, Republicans' obstruction, and relentless criticism of the Biden administration. They instigated too much division, Mr. Hendricks says of the Republicans. Basically, they've kind of boiled it down to politics and power play. They're not really solving issues, they're just keeping you divided so they can do whatever they want. Worries around trash piling up, flights cancelled because of staff shortages and rising grocery prices may be small compared with a global pandemic that has killed 5 million people, or a fast warming climate that has contributed to floods inundating towns and wildfires burning America's West. But they're stuck, like pebbles in a voter's shoes, tiny but impossible to ignore. Every day or so, my younger one will say, "Dad, there's no bus. Can you come and get me?" said John Radanovich, a 58-year-old, the father of an 8th grader and an 11th grader at Lake Worth, Florida, near West Palm Beach. Mr. Radanovich, a Democrat, says he believed the increasingly vocal dissatisfaction in the country on vivid displays as Republicans won the governorship in Virginia, flipped a Democratic statehouse seat in San Antonio, and routed Democrats in New York suburbs were likely to doom Democrats in 2022 midterm elections. There's so much hatred, Mr. Radanovich says, adding that he hoped to leave the country once his younger son finished high school. You can see it in the schools, the diet, our lifestyle, and the stress, how expensive things are. It's a mystery that life has become so much worse in the United States. It's just worse, worse, and worse.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.